Hey, this is Eric Thornburg. Welcome to another episode of Maker Stories, where we discuss what makes the makers, what they care about, what they grapple with, how they make sense of the world, and everything in between. This week's guest is Robert Green. Robert is an author of a bunch of books, including Mastery, 33 Strategies of War, The Art of Seduction, The Laws of Power, one of which is with rapper 50 Cent. And a lot of his books are outcome-oriented, kind of gaining power, seducing the woman or man. And one criticism of it is that some people don't want to be strategic about these things. They want them to be organic. But I think a better thing to say is that some of us not only care about getting the thing, the accomplishment or the relationship, but also the way in which we get the thing in the first place. Almost to the extent that I wonder if some people would rather not have the thing at all than to have gotten it in a way they don't feel proud of. In this podcast episode, we talk a bit about that when we discuss his books, The Laws of Power, The Art of Seduction, Mastery, what in his personal life has inspired the books. But we also talk about meditation, writing, him not having kids, and what's that meant for his life, and a lot more. It is a fun episode and a good conversation. All right, here's Robert. So, Rob, are manipulation and motivation the same thing?
Well, I'm not quite sure I understand the question. I have a unique take on manipulation, and my take, which is from, you know, the 48 Laws of Power and is pretty much in all of my books, is that people are all constantly manipulating each other. We're not completely conscious or aware of it. We're never exactly telling our boss what we think of what he or she is wearing or whether they have the best taste in music. We're always... there's a little voice in our head saying, well, maybe we shouldn't say this, we should say that to impress people. All kinds of things that we do, maybe a little bit unconsciously, that I believe are manipulative. So then there's full-on conscious and more kind of nasty manipulations that people go through. But I'm trying to take it away from this idea that, oh, there are just some people out there that manipulate and I'm a good person. I never do that thing. I'm saying human beings by nature, because we don't like feeling powerless, we're forced to in some way manipulate. And if ever we're completely honest, we're going to find ourselves in a lot of trouble. So I don't know how the link is to motivation. Maybe explain to me a little bit what you were thinking.
Well, is there room for moral considerations in power struggles?
Of course. It depends on the power struggle itself. I hate these like huge generalities. I never believe that physical violence is never part of the game. There's psychological coercion that I write about in the 48 Laws of Power. But my take is, the power game is fairly amoral, and it's up to you as an individual to bring your own ethics to it. And in the world that we live in today, which is in some ways fiercely democratic, and with all the sort of public shaming that tends to go on, you're not going to get very far in life if you operate by if you have no sort of moral radar. So if you want to be successful and you're not, and you are sort of a sociopath, you're going to have to sort of change your game.
What underlies your kind of moral compass? Is it intuition? Is it philosophy?
Well, you know, I'm of the belief that it's something that is deeply ingrained in you or is not. I think a lot of my own personal moral code comes from my father, who was a very decent man. He was a salesman. He wasn't highly successful as a businessman, but he treated people really well and really decently. And I think that just gets embedded in you somehow deep in your core. You absorb a lot of things from your parents. And then, of course, you know, when you're younger, when you're in your 20s, I know I didn't have as developed a code. I was really excited about getting ahead, advancing my career. And I would do things then that I just wouldn't do now. And so I think you learn over the years, at least just for me, as you get older, you do become a little more empathic. You do care a little bit more about people than maybe, and do things that you wouldn't do when you're younger, because you understand, you know, I understand from my early experiences what it's like to not be powerful, to have people play games on you. And I'm very aware of not of being on the other end of that. So I think I've developed a bit more of a ethical code as I get older.
On a societal level, how do you think we teach ethical codes, and how could we do a much better job at that? What should you know, education, or you know, what should we do?
Well, that's a great question, and it's something I'm addressing in my new book about human nature, and I'm trying to make the case that it really comes down to empathy. And empathy is almost something sort of physical that we humans have at birth. As a social animal, we have a tremendous ability to think inside of what another person's brain and imagine what they're feeling, what they're thinking. It stems from our earliest relationship with our mother, also with our father and our earliest siblings. And it's something that gets worn away as you get older, as you become a bit more selfish and self-centered. And also, there have been studies that have shown that levels of empathy, an interesting study beginning in the 70s, that has a test for measuring it, that empathy levels are going down, particularly among young people. You can argue why that's happening. But it's pretty much.
Why is that happening?
I don't know. I'm not the expert. I didn't do the study. If I had to speculate, I would say a lot of it is the social media and the fact that people aren't as social as they used to be. We're not in as many social situations. We're not interacting with people as much. There's more of virtual interaction, and when you're around people more and you sort of develop that muscle, I believe you also develop the empathy muscle. That's just my theory, and I can't prove it or demonstrate it, but the study is pretty ironclad. And so I believe that empathy is something that we're all born with. I'm not making a judgment that some people are superior. We all have faced the same problem. And it's a muscle. It's something that you can develop. And it's sort of what I'm writing my book about. And I think that's sort of the key, the ability to put yourself in other people's shoes, to feel what they're feeling as far as a moral code is concerned. I don't think preaching is very good. I don't think telling people, oh, you must be like this, you've got to change your way. People are very slippery. We're all accustomed to sort of faking the virtues that our culture promotes. So a lot of people appear to be moral and ethical. They support the best causes on Facebook, and they hit like for something that makes them look good, but really their actions don't back it up. So I don't think preaching it does any good. Getting at children at a very young age is important. I mentioned absorbing things from your parents, but empathy is something that everyone has the potential for, and it's something that you can develop and make stronger.
Is religion overrated or underrated?
It's just is. I'm not of that ilk that's against religion. I find religion a beautiful phenomenon. There are people who are religious, who are extremely nasty and hypocritical and awful. And there are atheists who are extremely hypocritical and awful. Human beings tend to bring their own nature to whether it's communism or capitalism or Christianity or atheism. So it's not, to me, a question of religion being overrated or underrated. I have been practicing for years a Zen meditation, which is a form of Buddhism.
Yeah, talk about that. I was talking to Ryan about, he was saying, Ryan Holiday, that you developed a kind of new meditation, ritual and new exercise ritual while writing Mastery. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, Mastery was a hard book to write, and it was a lot of pressure. I was very late in delivering it, and it was very complicated. And I knew going in it was going to be like that. So I thought, I've got to I've got to do something to help calm me down and deal with this. And so I took up meditation. I think it was about exactly 5 years ago, about when I was starting that book. I also exercise every day, and I kind of incorporated my exercise routine into, I amped it up a little bit. So I was sort of like training for a marathon, which a book can sometimes be. But mostly the meditation really, really, really helped me. I'm, you know, reading hundreds of books and dealing with, I think, complicated material and thinking a lot. And you can go kind of crazy like that. And you can start like not sleeping very well, and it catches up with you. And so the meditation routine, I think, has saved my life. I do it religiously, quote unquote, every morning.
What do you do? Just 20 minutes in the morning, or what's your routine?
It's 35 minutes in the morning, and it's very intense. You know, you sit in a lotus position, and it's essentially an emptying of the mind kind of exercise. And you know, in the beginning, you're not so good. Now, after I'm not at a master level by any means, but I'm much better at it now. And you, just emptying the mind and concentrating on a few things. I've taken classes, and I've trained under some teachers, so there are exercises. But just the idea of having that ritual every morning, emptying your mind, becoming more mindful, working through any emotional turmoil that you have, focusing on your body and physical things, and just calming the mind down has just really, really been wonderful for me.
What other life rituals do you swear by?
Well, I'm a creature of ritual because I think if you polled most writers, they would be the same, because it's sort of a hard life only in the sense that you've got no bosses, you've got nobody breathing down your neck, and you have to kind of train yourself. So usually rituals play a huge part. So my day tends to be, you know, very similar. Every third day I swim in the morning, and then I do other exercises the other 2 days. I have my tea in the afternoon at the same time. Then I have another cup of tea later in the afternoon. You know, that kind of thing. They're not rituals like the meditation, but there are kind of routines that you force yourself to get into, almost as if you were working in an office.
You know, I read Haruki Murakami's What I Think About When I Think About Running recently. Uh-huh. And it talks about how, you know, every day he runs and he writes, and running, you know, he says writing is kind of mentally unhealthy for him a little bit, and running counterbalances it.
Well, that's exactly right. First of all, it is unhealthy, the kind of obsessive nature of it. And the fact that, you know, sometimes you're staring at a blank page, and you don't know, you know, every day is a struggle where you have to figure out what you're going to do. And exercising, for me, swimming is the best, because you can't really think when you're swimming. You have no physical stimulus. There's nothing to look at. It just totally takes you out of that writing space and calms you down. But running, I'm sure, would do the same thing. And I also do mountain biking, which is similar to running. So I completely understand what he's saying.
Now tell me, because I get this all the time, I meditate too. When you're meditating or when you're swimming and you have a thought for a book or for, you know, is it for a chapter, do you take a break to write it down, or do you just file it away?
Well, I don't take breaks. It's pretty fascistic. You sit there, and if you have the most brilliant idea, which occasionally happens, you just file it away. You try and remember. I'm always of the belief, I've been doing this for many years, that if you have a brilliant idea, you're not going to forget it. It's going to come back to you at some point. If it's that brilliant and you forget it and you forget it forever, it couldn't have been that good. So I usually just wait till it's over, and then I incorporate it. But I try desperately to not think about the book or the project when I'm meditating. This is the time. It's like you're clearing everything away. It's like you're cleaning a room out, and you're not allowing anything in there. So I'm really try hard to, and for the first five or even 10 minutes, it's really difficult. The thoughts about what you're working on or thinking are just keep coming in, and you have to fight that, at least in this form of meditation. And then the other form of it is emotions, always these feelings that you sit down with of anger or resentment or whatever, and you have to kind of calm the body down and calm your whole emotional system down. And then after maybe 10, 12 minutes, you enter a deep state, and then a deeper state. So I try really desperately not to bring my work to that moment, those moments.
And when you put yourself, after the meditation, you find yourself just more aware and more present and bringing better thoughts to everything else you're doing?
Yeah, I mean, I wish it would last, the mood would last longer, but I've noticed what happens is some days are better than others, which, you know, is natural. We all have some days we all feel better than others. And there are times when it's been a really good 35 minutes, and it just puts me in a great mood the whole day. Nothing seems to bother me. It's not like I'm continually mindful, because I would have to meditate longer. I'd have to do it several times during a day. It just seems to elevate my mood and make I don't care so much about things or people say irritating things. Washes right over me. Those are the days when it's successful. And as I get deeper in the practice, I have more of those days.
Are there things that continuously irritate you?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'm writing a chapter right now on irrationality as one of the character traits of humans. I'm someone that tries to bring a somewhat rational approach to life. And I really, really, really get irritated by, particularly nowadays in the news or a Republican debate or whatever, the sheer level of irrationality that prevails, the way people argue, the kind of fake arguments that go on, the kind of heated atmosphere that we live in. All of these get under my skin. I mean, I could go on. I'm a sensitive guy and things are constantly irritating me. But that's part of the reason I took up meditation, was to not get irritated so much and just let things flow by. But I'm human and I'm not perfect, and things are continually irritating me. As a writer, I like quiet. I have to hear the voice in my head as I'm writing. So leaf blowers and things like that drive me crazy. You know, we could talk for four hours about what irritates me.
The 48 laws of power. This is your first book, and when you wrote it, you're in a very different place in life than you are now, and it's also a very different time. If you were writing that book today, what would you add, or what would you cut, or what would it be different about?
I don't really think like that. In other words, when I write a book, it's finished, it's over. I don't really look back. I don't read it again. And I'm on to the next project. And I take the idea that I did the best that I could at the 48 Laws of Power. I really feel like I caught, after all the research I did, I really caught the 48 that I wanted to catch. People ask me all the time, well, what's the 49th? And what are the other? I don't think there is anything that I've heard or that I've thought of that I missed. It's not perfect. There would probably be things I would rewrite now. But I just think I worked so hard on my books. They take several years. I put a lot of effort into them. And when they're finished, I move on. I think I did the best that I can. I don't like to go over and say, oh, I wish I had done this differently.
Have you had a situation where you've had to choose between, or could you tell me about a time when you've had to choose between something that was ethically right and something that would have advanced you in your career in some way?
I don't know if I have that kind of clear-cut example in my life. I know when I was younger, I mentioned when I was in my 20s, for work, I would do things as a writer, as a journalist, that weren't unethical. but I was like really low on money, and I would take articles and then almost like spin it into a second article. And that was a no-no, and I got called on it. Things like that, that, you know, I was just a little too ambitious and a little too poor. And then I saw things in Hollywood, bosses that would do really, I think, unethical things. Could I have stopped them? No, I couldn't have stopped them because I was like a low-level employee, or I'd be an assistant. I simply observed it. Now, afterwards, and I'm in the position I'm in now, I have the luxury of I don't have to really make those decisions. If people come to me and they want advice, and I suss out that they're not a good person, that they want advice to do something bad, I just won't do it, you know. And maybe sometimes I've been deceived. I don't think so. I have pretty good radar on that. I mean, I kind of wrote the book on it, so I sort of think I can figure out who's fooling me and who's not. So I have the luxury now of I don't take that work. If someone wants me to do something that I think is not right or wants advice that will lead to that. I remember once, actually, one of the first consulting jobs that I had was with a very big businessman in a brokerage firm. And he was paying me a lot of money for my advice. And then it became clear to me about two-thirds of the way that really what he wanted me advice on was seduction, and he was basically looking to seduce his secretary, even though he was a married man with children. And I just didn't go there. I just won't go there. I mean, you know, you have my book. If you want to use my book, go right ahead. But I'm not going to be the one that gives you this amazing advice to seduce your secretary and then ruin your marriage, and your kids will be damaged for the rest of their life by this horrible divorce. No, I'm not going to do that. So maybe that would be an example.
Let's get into that. But you wrote the Laws of Seduction.
The Art of Seduction.
Sorry, I read it. Comparing the two, how can power use to create love in one-to-one relationships?
Well, power isn't love, and seduction isn't love. I didn't write The Art of Love. I wrote The Art of Seduction. Seduction is a way to make people fall in love with you. And to some extent, I suppose you will fall in love with them. But it's not a guide to a long-term relationship. And if, you know, I didn't write that book. Now, I talk in the book about in a relationship, let's say you have seduced someone and then you stay on for a relationship. You do have to keep seducing them. People do still need a sense of drama and theater and a heightened sense of romance where you still care and you still do the things that you did before, maybe not as intensely because you're no longer trying so hard, but you still think of flowers or flowers are such a cliche, so I don't mean that, but some perfect gift for the other person. You take them to the right place. You still dress nicely. You put the effort in. You don't become all slovenly and just say, oh, well, I've got her now. I can just be myself. No, you keep seducing because it's a ritual. It's a mating ritual, and we love that. That's the part of it that we love, and we love the psychology involved, where our thoughts revolve around one person more and more and more. And so the fact that you sometimes are playing a game, I don't think it's a bad thing. Sometimes playing a game is a nice thing. It shows that you care. Of course, it can also be bad. So, you know, in The Art of Seduction, I do talk about how you can use this to keep the relationship alive, but it's not a book about how to find you know, your spouse and be married and live happily ever after.
And why haven't you written that book?
Because it, you know, other people are better at that. I'm a little more of the, I'm kind of a little more intrigued by the dark side of things in life. It's always been an attraction of mine. I find, in a Jungian sense, what we would call the shadow aspect of the personality, because I think it governs a lot of people's lives and actions, and no one writes about it. Mm-hmm. No one writes about power or seduction in that way. It's almost a taboo. We want to focus on Gandhi and the Dalai Lama and all these wonderful people and all these books written about management, and they're all focusing on how wonderful everyone is and Howard Schultz and Starbucks. And anybody who works in the real world knows that that stuff is just bullshit. It's right. not what you experience when you're working at Starbucks. It's not what you experience when you're working in Hollywood. So I want to write about something real. I'm really attracted to the gritty, real side of life. Other people can write about marriage. It's just not... And you got to write about what excites you, and that's not that doesn't excite me.
Growing up, whose love did you crave more, your mother or your father's?
Well, you know, I had a hard to say. I mean, I think every boy sort of needs, craves the care and attention of mother. And then I had a, you know, my father, I had a good relationship with. Probably in some strange way, for me growing up, the closest relationship and the most important relationship was to my sister. We're still very, very close because we became like best friends and we still are. And that, I think, I've talked to other people. Someday I even want to write a book about it, about people who had strong relationships with between a brother and a sister has very I think has can have a very powerful effect on you and tends to create a certain personality type. So I love my parents very much. My father passed away 15 years ago. My mother's still alive. But the relationship with my sister was in some ways the most important.
But there was something about the way, you know, you, in which you grew up that attracted you to the dark side early?
I suppose, you know, I've known a lot of people who are passive aggressive. I won't name names early on, and that kind of stuff would anger me and get me frustrated. And then I think, most importantly, was the work world. Because, you know, all of us, you know, we go to university, or those of us who do go to university, or even if you come out of high school and go straight to work, when you're young, you have a certain vision of life. It tends to be idealistic, and it's a beautiful thing. And you see, you tend to think this is what life's going to be like. And then you get out there, and usually you realize, well, there's a lot of shitty people out there, and you encounter them in the work world. And you're shocked and you're upset and you're disturbed about it, unless you happen to be one of those shitty people and then life seems normal to you. And you're kind of shocked by it. And that was, to me, the deciding factor of why I was attracted to why I write about that. Here you are in the work world, and there are these people who are extremely clever and manipulative and sharky. And they're the ones that get ahead often, not always, but often. And it's not really fair. It's not fair that the people who might have more talent but who aren't so sharky don't necessarily get the best positions. And that kind of unfairness and that kind of little bit of anger and frustration on my part was what I think really inspired me to go into what I write about.
That's interesting. Kind of, I didn't realize that, you know, kind of a sense of justice, kind of laying out the rules so that the nice guys can learn and adapt.
Well, I've made that clear in many interviews, and, you know, people can think I'm lying, but I think if you get to know me, and you can see people who have known me, or 50 who wrote 50 Cent I did a book with, you know, it's pretty clear I'm not one of those sharks. I'm not the guy from American Psycho. I'm more the other side. And that really was what kind of fueled me. And in the acknowledgments to the 48 Laws, I thank all the people who've manipulated me or did things on me because they sort of inspired this book. So I've made it clear that, you know, I'm more on the side of those who've had these things done to them. And law number 7 about always get other people to do the work but take the credit for it, which is a pretty nasty law. You know, I've made it clear in the past that that's what happened to me quite often in Hollywood, that I was on the other side of that law.
Now, The Art of Seduction, would you say in some ways was a precursor to the game and kind of the movements that followed? And how do you perceive that?
Well, I'm friends with Neil. We hang out. He's a great guy, Neil Strauss. And the game's a great book. Neil is a really great writer. And he talks about the Art of Seduction in it. And, you know, the paths do cross, but they're different. They're quite different in that the pickup artist world is more immediate. It's more about an immediate hit of, you know, how you get a woman in a bar and go up to her and have the guts to say something and get her excited and attracted, and what, you know, different tricks, different things to wear and stuff like that. And it's just not what the Art of Seduction is about. Art of Seduction is an art that will require days, weeks, months of seducing someone. It's a mental game. And, you know, often sex is the goal, but not always. I talk about social seductions, etc., in there. So sex is the goal, but it might take you a month. It might take you a year. Pickup artists don't have that kind of patience, and it's a different sort of game. I've hung out with them mostly through Neil. I've talked at their conventions and stuff.
What's been your experience with them? Are they happy people? Have you figured it out?
Well, you can't generalize about that, but. You know, obviously someone that's going to come to a pickup artist convention is feeling like they're not doing very well in that realm. So you're going to have, men in their early 20s who are a little unhappy about their relationships. I mean, that's going to be obvious. And it's a little daunting to see a couple thousand of them in a room. There's good and there's bad. I think Neil's a genuine person, and I think he's helped a lot of guys in dealing with women. And there are a lot of people who are just charlatans, who are just out for a buck, who play on men's insecurities, just like charlatans do on any other kind of game, like getting your money or whatever. And they're good at it, and they're dangerous, and I don't like them. And I've met quite a few of those, maybe more of those than the other side. I'm not going to name names, but so it's not my world. It's an interesting world, but I'm into something a little more longer lasting and psychological.
And what do you say to people who complain and say they don't want to play these mental games? Is it that they're just not being realistic about, you know, how seduction works, or that they're misinterpreting it, or that they're placing false ethics on it? What do you think about this?
I think that's fine. If you're a person that's comfortable with who you are, and you're in a relationship, or you're doing well, you found the man or woman that you want, and things are clicking, and that's your attitude, why would I have any problem with that? I don't want people to be unhappy. So that's great. But then there are a lot of people that it's false when they say that, because really they have a relationship to manipulation. A lot of times I find people who are really sensitive to those issues have been the victim of an evil seducer or a parent who tends to be a charmer or a narcissist. And they're very sensitive about it. And I understand that. But in a relationship, you never are completely honest. You never are being yourself. You are having to play a game. When you're from the male point of view, if you're really excited about a woman, you're going to take her to a place that you find interesting or that's suitable or that will put her in the right mood. Well, is that a manipulation? Is that a game? I mean, if you were just being yourself, you would take her to the corner bar and have a beer, or you take her to a Yankee game or something. But no, you're thinking a little more and you're going, well, maybe I'll take her to this really amazing restaurant that'll impress her, or maybe I'll take her to the ballet, even though I hate ballet. And then, you know, maybe I'll wear something that I don't normally wear. Are you playing a game? Are you being yourself? Who are you being? you decided to wear this interesting suit. Maybe you saw somebody else wearing it and you decided that looks good. And so who are you anyway? What is being yourself? We have many layers. We play different roles every day in our lives. We have the self at work. We have the self when we're trying to impress a woman. We have the self when we're riding in the subway. Who are we? So I just find people who are unhappy but tell me, well, I just want to be myself. I don't want to manipulate. I just find that kind of irritating. You ask me what irritates me. Well, that irritates me.
Because they're kind of missing the point.
They're not being honest. They're not being honest about themselves. They're very defensive, and they want to imagine that everything they do is good or right or moral. And I don't think there is anything wrong with dressing differently. Or, you know, I've been with the same woman for many years now, and she knows. She was there when I wrote The Art of Seduction. That I used one of the strategies on her.
How did she take that? What's been her perception?
I did it before I wrote the book. And it was basically I was trying to win her, and it wasn't proceeding smoothly. And I decided it was my birthday, and I had all of these really good-looking female friends. They were all going to be at this party in Santa Monica. And I made sure that I invited her to this, the one I was trying to seduce. I'm still with, knowing that to see me surrounded by all these beautiful women, you know, would have an effect on her, much as I describe in the book. And it did. And she admits it. And she knows I wrote about it in The Art of Seduction. She doesn't have a problem with it. She laughs about it. It's funny. And it's a psychology that we're all vulnerable to. If you see a woman who's surrounded by men and everyone likes her, you tend to also think she has value. You want to be interested. This is just human nature. So, you know, was I being dastardly? Well, I don't think so. It worked, you know.
You would think that someone who wrote The Art of Seduction would be in many relationships, you know, over time and not, and you have obviously, but not with,
I'm an older guy, so I'm in my 50s. So I can tell you, in my 20s, I was living the art of seduction. I wasn't the world's greatest seducer. I had more of an arc like Neil in the game, where I had to kind of learn it, if one can say that. And I had people who I did kind of look at as sort of teachers in an informal way. But in my 20s and early 30s. And through my 30s, you know, I was practicing the art of seduction. But at a certain point, you get a little tired of it, and you like having a relationship.
And talk about, you've talked in interviews how that's grounded you in your work. And it seems that it's been a trend among other high achievers to be in kind of solidified relationships over time.
Well, everyone has their own personal way of dealing with life. And there are going to be writers who are successful who aren't like that. So it depends on your profile. But it's a kind of a lonely life. And it can be difficult. And having having someone who's with you all the time, and the right person, and each one of us is complimenting the other and helping their life, making it better, easier for them. She's a filmmaker, and I help her with her films, and I help her with her writing, and she edits all of my books. It just makes life so much easier and so much better. If I were alone, and let's say, you know, I didn't have this relationship, but I was, you know, out there, meeting women in whatever way that would be now, that would mean for me, I would be like alone all day. I think I'd go crazy, to be honest with you. I'm a social person. I think I'd just literally, I'd go Ted Kaczynski or something. So in that sense, it really grounds me. It's also, you know, a really healthy thing to have a relationship, in that you learn the limits of your ego. You have to learn how to compromise. You have to learn how it's not all about you. It's a really healthy process.
One thing I wonder for myself, and I'm still in my mid 20s, but as I get older, I can't imagine not having, like cutting out the possibility of a first kiss again in life. What are your thoughts on open relationships or polyamorous relationships?
Well, I know people who are into that. I have a friend who's really into that. And I think it's fine. I have no problems with it. Men tend to be more into polyamory than women. I think it's pretty demonstrable that. I mean, there are some women who are really into it, but it's really, let's just be honest, it's something that appeals more to men. it's something everybody, I'm sure even the woman I'm with has twinges of this, like, dreams of other men or whatever, that who knows what goes on in her mind. So I think it's natural and normal. And I know what you're saying, and I understand it. And you're almost saying it as if it's like death. You know, I can't imagine being dead for the rest of my life. So I hear you. It's not, if life were perfect, there would be, we humans would be in open relationships, but it doesn't really work, I don't think.
And you don't see it working? Evolving?
No, I think it does for some people, but for the kind of life I lead and for the stability that I want and the kind of routines that I'm in, I think it would drive me kind of crazy. But if I were 25, I'd have no problem at all. Okay, but I'm 55, or 56 actually. So it's like, I don't know. That would be so tiring. I don't know if I could. I don't know if I could handle the emotional baggage.
Yeah.
Of all these different relationships at the same time.
And just the logistics alone.
The logistics would kill me.
A few people have responded, or over the years, some of the quotes about the 48 Laws of Power have been, there's one, they said, called it the psychopath's Bible. And I'm sure those are frustrating because you feel kind of miss the point. But what's a critique of your book or of you that you've read that you've thought, hey, that's actually, that resonates a little bit, or that's not crazy? Like, what comes to mind?
Well, obviously I wrote the books and I don't feel like it's a psychopath's Bible. So I don't have those sort of moments where I go, oh, they're right there. I mean, let's say over the years since 98, the book came out in 98, so we're talking now 17 years, I've probably received 5,000, I'm just pulling that number out of my head, but 5,000 emails from people who've read the book. I'm sure it's actually more than that. 95% of them are people that I mentioned earlier who are kind of more innocent types who are curious about this, who've had something done to them, and who come to it with the same kind of mindset that I have. If you're a psychopath, if you're like that guy in American Psycho, you don't need the 48 Laws of Power. I mean, if you need a book to be manipulative, you're already not manipulative. It's something some people are just brilliant at. There are people I know for The Art of Seduction. I've had emails from women who've said that they've been in the grips of some really awful, sadistic seducer, and they discovered The Art of Seduction on his bookshelf. Yeah, I feel bad about that. If the guy was probably already good at it, and he used the book to really pull a number on them, that's bad, and I don't like that. And in those cases I've actually tried to help some of these women break the spell, etc. But in general, the book isn't me. I'm not the book. I wrote a book about power, and I tried to say this is how people use power in the world. So it's not me and Robert Greene who is practicing these laws. The CEOs and other types are practicing them. So it doesn't mean that I'm that person. And I think a lot of people kind of understand that.
It seems that, you know, your books have a common thread in that there's some sort of fundamental misunderstanding of human nature that you're correcting for and kind of leveling the playing field. And your new book is actually going even further about, you know, to that point. Talk about your next project and what's upcoming for you.
Well, I wrote a book called Mastery. It came out a few years ago. And that book was a little bit different for me in that I was writing about what I think is the real true form of power in the world is to be a master in your field, to know it so well and to be really brilliant and creative. Then you can kind of write your own ticket in life. And so it's a book about that and how to become a master. But one of the chapters in the book was about social intelligence. And I wanted to give the idea that you could be brilliant in your field, but if you're bad with people, you kind of neutralize all of your talent and expertise. So social intelligence is a huge part of mastery. And in that chapter, I kind of instructed people on how to be better in dealing with people and judging their character. And I had a lot of feedback from it. People really connected to that. And a lot of them said, but, you know, it wasn't enough. I want more. I want a whole book on that. And I thought, well, it's a subject that fascinates me. And so in that chapter, I talked a lot about human nature. And I had these sort of seven deadly realities about human nature. And what I've done is I've sort of expanded that to 24 deadly realities about human nature. And each one sort of encompasses a quality that I think is timeless, that's really embedded in us. You could say neurologically or biologically. Chapters on envy, on passive aggression, on how we judge people based on appearances, irrationality, narcissism. And I'm showing you how that operates in people, and how you can see it and not be so naive, and how you can overcome these qualities to become actually a better person, a more rational person, a more empathetic person, and not just have these qualities without being aware of them. And so I go deeply into each one of these qualities. I've been working very hard on the irrationality chapter, which is the most important and biggest chapter in the whole book, is basically saying that humans, we like to think of ourselves as being a thinking animal, you know, like almost like we're a computer, but in fact, we're governed by our emotions. Emotions determine our behavior. They infect our thinking process. They have an influence on our actions that you're not even aware of, and it creates irrationality. And so I'm showing you how that happens and how you can be aware of it and become rational. And I'll be doing that for 23 other topics. So that's the book.
Let's tackle the envy one for a second. Where does that stem from, and how can we overcome that?
Well, I'm trying to base everything in something very primal. So I can say that it goes back at least 3,000 years and maybe 100,000 years. And envy, I think, is a function of the nuclear family and how we're raised, where we have two parents and siblings. And unless you're an only child, but even if you are an only child, you're in competition for the attention of your parent, of your primary caregiver. And also there's triangles going on between both parents and you and between other siblings. And that sense of, I want what another person has. I don't want them to have what I have. That kind of competitive thinking is so deeply, deeply human that it's involved in a lot of what we do every day. It's how advertisers play on us. Oh, I saw that great car. That guy has that car. I want the car that he has. It's the nature of our desire is very competitive. And envy is a emotion that we all feel. It's ridiculous for people to not admit it. Just like I wanted to say, we are all irrational. Let's stop getting over this idea that some aren't. It's just our nature. We all feel envy. It's so human, but some people feel it more. They are more insecure. And the problem with envy is you never admit that you're feeling it, because who wants to admit that they're envious? You'll never find that person that will say, you know, I'm motivated because I'm envious of what that person has. You'll find another reason for your behavior. You'll say you hate them or whatever it is. And so it's a very deadly emotion, because people will do things under the influence of envy that can be very destructive and sabotaging, and they're not honest about it, and you're not aware of it, and you don't even understand where it's coming from. So I want to show you how it's in constant operation. I see it every day on Facebook, et cetera, but I see it, you know, people I interact with. And I'm just going to show you how it's out there in the world and how you feel it and how you can overcome it.
Your approach, it's kind of like an essentialist approach, where you take, if I understand correctly, very complex phenomena and really boil them down to their essence. Is something lost when you boil these like very complex phenomena into concepts?
Of course, everything is lost, and it's the nature of thinking and putting things in words. You're not exact, and I struggle with that. I'm not exactly communicating the reality. I can't do that, you know. And sometimes you think, well, you know, and that's where these books become so difficult for me, because I want to cover everything. I want to be true. I want to get at what's really going on, and I'm not quite there. I'm missing something. Even when it's finished, I'm sure that there are things that I missed. Although I told you I don't like to go back. So, you know, it's when you're coming up with concepts and generalizations, you're missing something. But one thing that I am trying to make the point in the book is, being a student of human nature and having social intelligence is like this dance, where you're, on the one hand, you're aware of these trends that people feel envy, that people are irrational, that we're by nature narcissistic, etc. But on the other hand, you're dealing with individuals, and that person isn't a stereotype, and they're not exactly fitting a mold, or they're not like anybody you've met. So on the one hand, you're looking at the qualities that people have that we all share, and at the other hand, you're looking at what makes them different. Now, I can't cover that difference in a book. It would be 50,000 pages, but I'm making it very clear in many, many chapters how you have to get inside each person as an individual and figure out what makes them tick, and understand those kind of general qualities that you can see displayed.
Mm-hmm. You know, what I find really refreshing is that in an era where, you know, people dabble in many things, or it's all about kind of page view journalism, you have five, you know, kind of defining books on, you know, power, war, seduction, mastery. What are some of the big things you've had to say no to or trade off in your, you know, quest for mastery?
Well, you know, everybody comes to me with, you know, they want to do a YouTube channel with me giving lectures. Something I, you know, I could be interested in doing at some point, but I just don't have the time, because the books are so time intensive. And so the projects like that I'm always getting hit up for, or sometimes there are celebrities, it's not that often, who want, after the 50 Cent book, I wrote a book with 50 Cent, who want me to do a book with them. Sometimes they're consulting jobs that I just don't have the time for. I do consulting, and some of it's very interesting, and it's really been an amazing ride. And then I am doing a television project, which is eating up my time, but I have to figure out what really is important and what isn't. And learning to say no is something really valuable, you know. And I know as you get older, for me, it's like I just don't have as much energy, so I can barely handle two projects. I can't handle three things at the same time.
Right. Let's close with some rapid fire questions. Now, they don't have to be rapid fire answers, of course.
Yes.
But first, talk briefly about your relationship with 50 Cent, especially in the context of, you know, I'm not sure exactly what happened, but the news of him, you know, filing for bankruptcy or...
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, people have asked me that because they think it's a little bit ironic in that the book we did, The 50th Law, is I'm trying to show what makes 50 so successful and so powerful. And in that book, it was a project we did together, and he came to me because he was a big fan of the 48 Laws. But it basically, you know, it's about his fearlessness, his fearless quality, and how it made him powerful. And people will say, well, you know, he's filed bankruptcy. I mean, doesn't that sort of debunk your book? No, no. First of all, bankruptcy has many different meanings. I'm not trying to spin this. It isn't a good thing. And he probably has been living a little bit beyond his means. But the point of the book was that this isn't a book about money. It's a book about power. And 50 being 50, if you want to go right now and place a $10,000 bet with me in Vegas, I will place the bet that he will come out on top in several years, that the bankruptcy will be behind him and he'll be in a really good position. Because he knows the power game. The guy's really savvy, and a lot of powerful people, including quote unquote Donald Trump, have gone through bankruptcy, and have come out smelling like a rose. So you know, this is not the last chapter for 50 by any means.
Knowing what you know now, what's some advice you would tell your 25-year-old self?
Well, you know, the problem that I had when I was 25 was I wanted to be a writer. That was my dream, and I could never quite make it happen. And basically, I was just impatient. I never took a project and went all the way to the end. I just wanted to do too many things. I was living. I was having fun. I was traveling. But when I was 25, if I had just stuck to that one book that I had, if I just trusted myself or that screenplay, and not, you know, cavorted all over in 20 different directions, trying 20 different things, I probably would have had success earlier on in life. And maybe that would have been a good thing, or as far as a writer is concerned. So I would have told myself, calm down and maybe for 3 months, go to a cabin and write the goddamn book and don't sit there and think about it and just do 3 pages and here and there. I was just too scattered. I think that's what my advice would have been.
How can technology be used to leverage the laws? How does that change the playing field?
Well, I want to make a point that these laws transcend technology, and that technology is a way to sort of, you know, we bring our human nature and our power games to technology. They don't change us. We change them. The internet starts off as this sort of free-flowing format where people can just exchange ideas, et cetera, and then look what it turns into now. You know, it's like mostly a medium for advertising. We end up turning it into what humans are. So some of it's great. You know, Law 48, assume formlessness. There's a kind of a flow and formlessness that people have nowadays that I think kind of fits with the cyber world that we live in, that's kind of interesting. And people are more formless in that we kind of don't have a job for 40, 30 years like my dad did. He worked at one place. We kind of flit from one thing to another. Our lives are much more fluid and open. So there's certain laws of power that fit really well with the new kind of paradigms that are going on. And I wrote Mastery very much with technology in mind to say that it's this amazing tool. Let's just put it in the framework of Mastery for a second. It's this amazing tool, but it can also be the death of you in that it makes you distracted, unfocused, extremely impatient. On the other hand, you have access to information and knowledge and skills that, you know, in one click, you can get what it would take Da Vinci 20 years to accumulate in books, et cetera. Unbelievable power. So it's a tool, and you can use it really poorly or you can use it really well. And that's how I feel about it for all the other books.
One thing I've wondered, also sharing kind of your obsessive curiosity about things, is, and of course I'm a bit younger, but is if, you know, for my friends that have kids, I can't imagine stifling that curiosity to be responsible, like solely responsible for another, you know, another person. How have you, my understanding, I don't think you have kids. How have you thought about that in your life?
Well, you know, I it's something I missed. You know, you don't get everything in life. It just ended up that way, I guess, for us. We thought about it at some point. I think it would have made it really difficult for me to write my books. So, and Anna, the woman I live with, she wanted, it would have probably really made it hard for her to make her films. So we sort of made a decision, but nothing in life is perfect. I have a lot of friends who have kids, and it's an amazing thing that I'm always going to miss. But then they bitch and bitch and bitch, like, oh man, I'm so jealous of you, Robert. I wish I could have had the free time to just write what I want and do what I want. Instead, I had to da 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 da. So everybody kind of wants what they don't have. We tend to romanticize it. I know that I'm missing something. I'm missing a relationship. I'm missing a kind of limit to learning your own limits and learning the frustrations and learning just an incredible experience that I'll never have. So
if you can go back, do you think you would want kids?
Yeah, I mean, I would. And now I'm in a position I could, but that's just life, you know? I mean, we're born and then we die and life is short. And I just don't have time myself for wishing what something that didn't happen. I had a chapter in the 50-cent book about fate and amor fati, loving the fate that you have, embracing what happens to you and accepting it and not thinking, oh, damn, I wish I'd have been this, that, and the other thing. I mean, I know people who do that and I go, you know, you're just going to shorten your life with that kind of thinking. So I know I'm missing something. I know it's an amazing, beautiful experience I'm not going to have, but I've made my peace with that.
And books are their own way of passing your ideas on. And
yeah, sure. And who knows? I could have had a son, and he could have turned into Hitler. You know, then I'd have that on my head, on my conscience.
Yeah.
So you know, you got to look at it that way.
Absolutely. What do you want people to say at your funeral?
I want them to have a really good time at my funeral. I don't want them to say what a great person he was. He was so loving and caring and all this other bullshit. I just want them to play some music and dance and have some fun and laugh, and particularly laugh and make fun of me and actually highlight all the irritating qualities that they found in me. That would be great. That would be a great funeral, because that's certainly not what usually funerals are like.
That's interesting. You know, I feel like I was, for myself, going for the former, where I wanted people to say good things about me, but now I just feel so lame and self-indulgent.
Well, I mean, I don't want to be, you know, falsely humble here. I mean, that would be kind of, I just think, I've always cut people down to size. So why shouldn't people do that to me as well?
No, it's a nice thought. Well, cool. Robert, thank you for taking the time. This has been a fantastic interview.
A lot of
the readers, you know, a lot of our audience are big readers, as well as myself. Now, you mentioned, you know, you have a book upcoming. You mentioned you have a television project upcoming. Any other plugs? Where can people find you on the internet? Where can people learn about these upcoming projects, or when can they expect them?
Well, the book, which is tentatively called The Laws of Human Nature, is I'm really behind on it. So probably we're looking at another 2 years. But believe me, I'll go as fast as I can. The television project may never happen because that's the nature of Hollywood. But we're working on it, and we're aiming for a pilot that would be all done by early next year. So if everything goes right, probably next year sometime there would be the 48 Laws of Power on television. But you know, honestly, at this point there's maybe a 25% chance of that happening, which isn't bad. It's gone up from where it used to be, which when I used to say it was like a 2% chance. As far as following me, I have my mastery website, which I suddenly forgot what the address is. Ryan will or you can look that up. And then I have powerseductionandwar.com, powerseductionandwar spelled out .com. And there's a email address there if you want to write me. Was there anything else that I forgot to answer?
No, I mean, it just is refreshing that the delayed gratification, I mean, you just don't see that nowadays. You know, for you to say it'll come out in 2 years, you know.
Oh my God, it's like I wish it wasn't. I'm not happy with it, but and maybe I'll pick up momentum. It's always hard to get that first chapter out, but yeah, you really have to be patient and very delayed gratification. So, you know, you write a book, and then for 3 months, everyone's talking to you, and you're flown here and there, and da da da. And then for 2 years, like, no one could give a shit about you, and you have to be able to live with that.
Yeah. Thank you, Robert. Perfect place to end. Appreciate you taking the time.